If you want to save time for rebuttal, just please watch the clock.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 2 minutes, if that's okay, and may it please the court. My name is Jacob Phillips. I represent the plaintiff in this action. This is a TCPA case arising from an order on a motion to dismiss, dismissing the case. The issue on appeal here is not whether the TCPA was violated. Pursuant to the allegations, it's assumed that it is. The question is whether the defendant is vicariously liable for those violations.
I can hear you pretty good, but can you just pull that microphone up or get closer? There you go. Thank you.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. The question is whether defendant is vicariously liable based on principles of agency, either actual agency, apparent agency, or ratification. Here, based on the allegations, we have a brokerage firm who was trying to assist homeowners in buying or selling houses, and they had their salespeople call on their behalf.
So, counsel, let me interrupt and just get right to it. It appears that the district court only addressed one of the 10 factors we set out in Jones. Is that enough for us to just remand to the district court to have them, engage in a fuller agency relationship?
I think that it is, Your Honor, yes. Also, Jones was decided on summary judgment. This was decided on the pleading. So even some of the factors in Jones don't even make sense at the pleading stage. Where the court erred was in applying the summary judgment standard at the pleadings and relying on Jones, and also failing to distinguish the fact that Jones was a case where the company that called was sued. They went bankrupt. So then they sued and tried to get the parent, so to speak, or whatever. That company that called represented 25 different companies. And so they would call. They would find out if your car had any issues. Based on if your car had issues and where you lived and all of that, they would then pick which of the 25 companies, one of which was the defendant, and say, hey, you should go with these people. If anything, the defendant in Jones was the client of the person who called, right? This case is not that. This case, under Nevada law, the salespeople can only represent one brokerage firm. They only work for that brokerage firm. The brokerage is responsible for their actions under Nevada law. This is not a case where a salesperson is calling, hey, do you want to sell your house? Where is it? Okay, based on where you are and if you want to sell, let me pick between one of 15 different companies that I'm going to place you with. That's not what we have here. And so the level of control that Jones found lacking made sense, right? In fact, in Jones, the plaintiffs, they never even got to the defendant. They called and said, hey, do you have some issue with your car? Do you need a service contract? The plaintiff said no. They never even got to Jones. So, of course, the point that this court made in Jones was you weren't even offering the defendant services. You never even got there. Of course there was no control. They haven't even decided that the defendant was the one of their 25 different clients that they were going to suggest to the recipients that they go with. So yes, absolutely. That by itself is enough to remand and wait until summary judgment and then do the 10-step analysis.
Your complaint mentions that the company gave these agents a list of people to call. One of the documents that your friend on the other side points out to is a cover email to the list that had Ms. Usanovic's phone number. And the cover email says, quote, you are instructed to screen each number for both the federal DNC do not call list and the company internal DNC list before calling any number. So first, can we consider this email here at the pleading stage? And second, if we can, does this undermine your case here about authority?
Thank you. All right. Two questions, two answers. As to the first, even the district court didn't consider it quite correctly. Defendant can't have it both ways. You can't file a Rule 12 motion rather than a Rule 56 motion, but then ask the court to consider evidence outside the pleadings. The district court correctly at the transcript said, I'm not considering that. You didn't file a Rule 56 motion. So no, the court should not consider that email. As to the second question, though, even if the court considered it, it's like they gave them the number, right? I'm imagining two people, right? The person comes and says, hey, you work for me. You call people on my behalf, right? You offer my services. Yeah, okay, here's a number. Don't call it. That person may get it and be like, well, then why are you giving me the number? Sounds like you kind of want me to call this number, right? And so I think a jury could reasonably find, no, the agent would have understood they're supposed to call those numbers. The fact that they had a CYA thing at the end of an email saying, hey, check it against the DNC, doesn't change that. And in fact, the reason why I think a jury could reasonably find that is because 9 different people thought that's what defendant was saying. 9 different individuals got that email. If they even saw the CYA language, they ignored it and they called anyway.
On the other side is saying that for apparent authority, at least, it requires detrimental reliance. Is their understanding of the law correct?
It is not. Also, to that point, even if the email is relevant, it would only remove actual authority. It wouldn't have anything to do with apparent authority because the plaintiff didn't know that they had said, don't call this number, right? As to your question, Your Honor, no. The detrimental reliance is not an element. That's clear under this court's precedent. It's clear under the third restatement. The confusion comes from one, the conflation of actual authority and apparent authority, and it comes from the fact that it must be reasonable to think that they are an agent. And so that language, the third restatement points out that some courts have used that language to then think that you then have to take some step in support of that reasonable perception in order for there to be harm. Now, that might make sense when we're talking about like a tort that requires some sort of action by the victim, right? But here, the violation occurred, if it had occurred at all, when the call was placed.
But counsel, like,
the recipient couldn't have relied on anything, right?
Counsel, sorry, but doesn't the restatement third say it is reasonable for a third party to believe that an agent has authority so long as that belief is traceable to manifestations of the principal? So what are those manifestations?
The manifestations of the principal don't have to be under the awareness of the recipient, right? And so the manifestations are all of the things that we allege. They listed them on their website. They told them who to call. They told them what to say when they call. They said, offer our services, call on our behalf, say these things to these people, use these callers to place the calls. All of those things were the manifestations.
But they also said, hey, check to see if they are on that do not call registry list.
Right.
And to use your argument, they can't have it. You can't have it both ways. You can, on the one hand, say, hey, when they tell you to do something, you're going to do it. But they didn't mean it on this time. They didn't mean it when they said, don't call these people.
I think that goes back to what we were talking about before. I think that a jury could reasonably find that, again, giving someone a list of numbers saying, hey, you're supposed to call a bunch of people. Here's a list of those numbers. Maybe don't call some of them.
I could see your argument would be stronger, maybe under apparent authority, but actual authority. Is there something directing them?
I think that there is, at the very least, the allegations are sufficient to plausibly infer implied actual authority. In other words, the express authority would be, hey, here's 555-1111, call this number, right? That would be express authority. Maybe there's not allegations of that. Implied authority is, here's a list of numbers, you should call them, and here's what you should say when you do. It would be reasonable for the agent to think that they're supposed to call those numbers. Now, again, a jury could find maybe that including a little caveat one time of saying, hey, maybe run this by the federal DNC before you call. Maybe that removes the actual authority. But I think a jury could also reasonably find that that's not enough. That's a factual question to be decided by a jury or at least at summary judgment. Nine different agents thought that they were being told to call those numbers. I think that by itself is a pretty sufficient evidence that a jury could agree with those nine different people. They weren't all unreasonably misunderstanding what they were being instructed to do.
How many agents received that?
I'm sorry?
How many agents received the list?
I don't think that's in the complaint, and I don't know as I stand here. I know how many called, and it was nine. So I'm less than 2 minutes, so unless the court has...
One question. The cover email, was that produced to you? Was that something you had before you drafted the complaint?
That was attached to their opposition to the motion to dismiss. I don't hold me to this, but I think that we were aware of the email. By we, I mean the plaintiff and counsel in the court below. I think that they were aware, but I'm honestly not sure. It was attached to the opposition to the motion to dismiss. With that, I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Great. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Jeff Toper on behalf of Appley Americana LLC, doing business as Berkshire Hathaway Home Services. I have a different role here. I'm going to get to the court's questions very quickly because I understand what the court wants to hear about. But I think just first, there are three independent bases upon which the court can affirm today. Any of them will work. The first is that the complaint didn't plead control adequately. That's an element of the vicarious liability test. Second, the complaint didn't adequately plead any basis for authority, be it apparent, actual, apparent, or ratification. And then the alternative basis, which we raised, is the statutory argument that 227C of the TCPA protects residential telephone subscribers and Ms. Husinovic as a cell phone user. Let me just jump right to it, Judge Dabo. You asked about the 10 factors in Jones. Should we send this back? And I will recognize that the district court, in our view, got the vicarious liability analysis correct. I'm not sure that Jones and the respondeat superior approach was the best way to get there, the best path to get there. Ms. Husinovic did not allege respondeat superior. But what the district court was doing was looking at Jones, which, you know, clearly is relevant and controlling here, and saying, what are the indicia of control? And it applied that test. Whether it applied that test or whether it applied the different test under the restatement, the district court got to the right result. There just was no allegations that the defendant had the ability to control the behavior of these agents. And if you look at comment F to section 101 of the restatement third, it talks about this. And it says, like, you have to have constraints and the interim right to give instructions. And that's not what was pled here. What they're doing, and we've talked about the email, and I'll get to that in a minute, Your Honor, but is laying out standards, basically compliance with the law. And then what BHHS, is doing is, like, they're teaching these independent agents how to go out and sell. And so they've given them all of these resources that they can use if they want to.
Well, they're more than teaching, counsel. I mean, and this goes to their apparent authority argument. They're provided the, you know, they're provided the names on their websites. They're telling them what to say. They're telling them to identify themselves as from BHHS. So they're doing more than just sort of teaching, right? They're teaching them what to say and representing to a third person who they are.
They are saying, look, here's how you could do this if you want to do it, okay? This is optional. You don't have to follow these scripts. Some of the other cases that have been
relied. Right, but that would go to the actual control. And I get your point on that, and I think that's their weakest argument for that. But for apparent control, aren't the things that they listed in their complaint sufficient?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And I think if there's no control, the case is over because they have to show that they've adequately pled control, and then they have to show one of the branches of authority, actual authority, apparent authority, or ratification. And I don't think that they've done that with respect to these, you know, tools that they make available, right? You don't have to use any of these tools. You could go out and knock on a door. You could see that, you know, there was a real estate sign out there, and you could say, hey, you know, I see your house didn't sell. But these are all optional choices, and they're not saying if you don't do this, then there will be any consequences for you, right? There's no adverse outcome if an agent elects not to use the tools that are
No, correct, available. But it's what the listener is hearing, right? What the third party is it reasonable for them to believe that they are acting under the principle, and in this case, they were told, instructed, as you mentioned, to call and identify themselves as associated by BHHS, that they were trained to say and identify themselves and gave them the numbers to do it. Why isn't that, as a listener, why isn't that reasonable for them to believe?
Your Honor, if we're talking about apparent authority, which I believe we are, my understanding of the test of apparent authority is that the representation has to be made to the third person, Ms. Husinovic. She hasn't alleged that there were, I mean, other than somebody said, I am calling, I'm an agent for BHHS. That's all she's alleged. She hasn't alleged she looked at the website. She hasn't alleged she was aware of any of this training. And if an individual can say, I am an agent with BHHS, and that's enough to create apparent authority, then it doesn't work that way. The court has said that in the NLRB versus Ironworkers case and the Thomas versus Taco Bell case. So I would commend the court to those decisions, which I think are dead on the apparent authority issue.
So for apparent authority, your view is the representation or the indication that the principal ordered this, does that have to come from the principal directly, or is it enough that the agent suggests that the principal directed the agent to act?
Oh, I'm sorry. I think it needs to be made to the third party, Ms. Husinovic. And then
the principal directly have to do that, or is it enough that the agent's statements strongly suggest that?
Well, I'm sorry. I don't think that just saying I'm an agent for BHHS is enough. But again, there are these allegations about what the website says in the Second Amendment complaint. There's no allegation in the Second Amendment complaint where Ms. Husinovic traces some reasonable belief that these individuals who called were authorized to do so. That's simply missing.
But
and that's
they?
A critical link.
Were they? Were they on the website?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Were they on the website?
Well, the complaint has, you know, screenshots of folks that are on the website.
So they've alleged that they were on the website.
They've alleged that, but they haven't alleged that she looked at the website and saw this and said, oh, okay, these people must be
authorized.
Well,
we have to take the allegations, counsel, as they come, right? We have to take those allegations in the complaint.
Yes, and there's a missing allegation is what I'm trying to say, Your Honor. So if I could shift and address Judge Lee's question about the email. I scoured the district court's order again, and maybe I missed it in blindness, but I didn't see anywhere in there where it said, yes or no, I'm not considering the email. The email, which was produced in third-party discovery to the plaintiffs and was available to them before they filed the second amended complaint, was it was attached to our motion, and we argued incorporation by reference, right? And because they have alluded to it in paragraph 88 of the second amended complaint, and so we're like, here it is. It says right here, you know, here's the list today, and this is just part of the list, which relates to Ms. Husinovic. And it has her name, it has information about her house, and then it has three phone numbers listed for her. And two of those are in red, and this is all below the admonition, don't call these people that are on the do not call list, right? So, you know, I think that the court can take not judicial notice of it, but it can be incorporated by reference, and it's for completeness to fill out what's alleged in paragraph 88.
Can I ask you about your Loper-Bright issue? And in my mind, what do we make of the fact that Section 227C uses the term residential telephone subscriber versus residential telephone line in 227B? And it does so in the section that is discussing the FCC's rulemaking authority. Why shouldn't we look at that and say, hey, there's a distinction, an important one. And in fact, the FCC since 2003, it's my understanding, has had a rule saying that cell phones are going to be treated for purposes of this statute as within the statute. Why isn't that persuasive?
Well, first of all, the 2003 order, it creates a presumption, right? That's all that it does. You know, following Loper-Bright and following McLaughlin, this court can look at this anew, right? It has the authority to do that. You can defer to the FCC.
What level of deference is there? Is there any? Is there some?
There's some level of deference. There's some level of deference, but you're free to disregard it, right? That much is understood. I think that, you know, this is really, we're making kind of this plain language argument, Your Honor, and residential telephone subscriber has to be referring to somebody. Residential telephone, everybody understood at the time in 1991 that this is a landline, right? Because the TCPA talked about landline.
Right, but here's this is the sort of the textualist argument, which is like there's two uses of the word here. There's a line, and then in the agency shall indicate you know, the protections, there they use subscriber, not line. There's a difference.
Right, but subscriber modifies residential telephone is our position, right? And what's a residential telephone? It is a landline, right? That's where we fall on that.
Also, would it be inappropriate for me to read residential as just meaning home as opposed to a commercial line? And subscriber to mean the phone's user and the purpose for which the phone is being used, not the physical location of the phone?
I'm not quite sure I'm following Your Honor's question. I apologize.
So, you know, you're saying residential in your mind means landline. I'm saying residential in my mind just means not in a business setting. Doesn't necessarily mean attached to a wall in a house. I can use my cell phone at home, and therefore I'm using it for residential purposes. I'm at home talking on the cell phone. And a lot of people now, I think my bigger issue too is we have a lot of folks who don't have residential landlines anymore. They just use cell phones in their home as a primary mode of telephone communication.
Right.
So would that make this then, under your argument, almost obsolete? Like there's no...
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, you have to interpret this as it was written in 1991 at the time, right? And things have changed. You know, I get the tension. I've probably gotten 2 spam calls while I'm standing here, right? But, you know, I think you have to recognize that you can still register on, you can put your number on there, right? The FTC, the commission can go after people. I mean, other government authorities may be able to. What it's doing is just you don't have a private right of action. And in 1991, could Congress have, you know, thought of these things differently? Certainly. Cell phones were kind of a novelty then. Yeah. I didn't get my first one until I worked here in about 1997. And if there are policy concerns that the court has, the Supreme Court told us in Facebook, that's for Congress. It's not for the court to resolve. I see that I've taken up 2 minutes more of my time. So unless the court has anything else it'd like to ask me.
But thank you.
Thank you.
Very quickly, just as a grammatical point, subscriber does not modify residential. Telephone subscriber is the noun phrase. It's the adjective noun phrase. Residential modifies subscriber. So just to clean that up. On apparent authority, the quote from this court is apparent authority results when the principal does something or permits the agent to do something, which reasonably leads another to believe the agent had the authority he purported to have. So it does not have to be a direct communication from the defendant to the plaintiff. If they permit the agent to do something, that is sufficient. Now, they did put these people on their website as their salespeople, as their agents or whatever. So they did take an action, but also the agent called and said, hey, I'm calling on behalf of Berkshire Hathaway. Would you like to use their service? A reasonable person would say, you know what? I bet that person is an agent of Berkshire Hathaway, and that's why they're calling me and trying to get me to go with them to sell my home. It would be very reasonable for the plaintiff to think that, and she did, ergo the lawsuit. So opposing counsel says, well, she never alleged I saw the website. Well, it's her lawsuit. She's pointing to the website. Clearly she saw it. On the Loper-Bright point, the only thing that's a really fun textual argument. I'd love to have it. The only thing I would point out is what we said in our brief, which is that this court, Jeanette already said, cell phones can be residential telephone subscribers. And what the Supreme Court strongly implied, and which this court has actually adopted in Lopez, is that the prior panel rule still applies, even if it was decided under Chevron before Loper-Bright. In other words, Loper-Bright doesn't then mean that we're starting from a blank slate all the time. So the prior panel rule still applies, and this court has already said that cell phones can qualify under 227C. I'm over my time. If the court has additional questions, happy to answer them. Otherwise,
remind me the case.
Which one?
The one that you just mentioned.
Chenette is where this court said that cell phones qualify.
Well, but wasn't that a concession? I thought it was a it was an agreement. Not it wasn't. It wasn't really argued.
It was a holding that cell phones can qualify under 227C.
By agreement, though, I thought.
That might be true. As I'm sitting right here, I'm a little bit nervous about it. But this court has found, in other words, it's applied to 27C to cell phones, and Lopez has said that the prior panel rule applies even post Loper-Bright.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I appreciate it. We would just ask that the order on appeal be reversed.
Great. Thank you both for the helpful argument. The case is submitted.